This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott.
The American economy.
Climate change without.
Hacking.
Different religions in it.
Sustainability.
Social media.
Security. Freedom.
Technology.
Marriage.
Essentially ethics.
Privacy.
It all started with a sentence. Near the end of last year, I was preparing for an interview and came upon this little piece of wisdom from Albert Einstein, who wrote, "Common sense is the collection of prejudices acquired by age 18. I began to think about how different the world was when I was 18, lo, those many years ago, and wondered how much of what I believed was inherited and how much I had consciously chosen. Maybe it was the frenzy of the holidays, or maybe more news of entrenched ideologies grinding our political system to a halt, or maybe just the prospect and promise of a new year on the horizon. But my colleagues and I settled in on this idea of rethinking how we do things and created Rethink 2014. We looked for rule breakers and paradigm shifters and people who had new slants on the things that we think about, like relationships and kids and power and the economy and the environment. Happily, many of you responded to this first of the year brain reboot. So today we are recapping a few of the most resonant ideas to carry into the rest of the year, beginning with the guy whose book started all this off, Roman Krznarek. His book, How Should We Live, is where I found the Einstein quote. It peers into the near and ancient past for examples of how people through the ages approached love and work and family and time and money and death and creativity. Roman urged us to consider our own power to reinvent time. How, I asked him. If everybody runs on the same clock and buys into the real-time need for response and attention, how do we alone function inside of a culture with our own notion of time?
I think the first thing to do is to get a bit of historical perspective and think, look, Leonardo da Vinci, he wasn't constantly looking at his watch or checking his electronic calendar when he was painting The Last Supper. You know, it doesn't have to be this way, and our obsession with time is something of a social invention. I mean, the first thing to do, I think, is to try some, you know, putting yourself on a chronological diet, I like to think of it. So try and spend a weekend without a watch, without clocks surrounding every wall around you in your house. And it could be a total disaster, but you might find it strangely liberating. But equally, I think we can indulge in slow time activities. If you go to a museum or art gallery, don't try and see everything. Go and see one room or even one painting and see what it does to you. I mean, something I do every morning, in fact, which I did this morning, which is I go out into my garden or into a park and try and find one thing that has just changed, a tiny little change in nature. And it brings a moment of stillness into the day, and I think can help us at least deal with some of that overload of emails and phone calls we're constantly getting and put you into a bit of a different zone.
Time is also a subject that interests Eldar Shafir, professor of psychology and public affairs at Princeton. In the new book, Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much, Shafir and his co-author, Sandeel Mullanazan, explore how scarcity influences human behavior and actually alters the brain. They look at the effects of not only having enough time, but not enough money or sleep or security or food or even friends.
We can take somebody and make them poor in time or money, and within a very short time, what you find is that they now devote a lot of their attention to this area where they're feeling poor, where they're not having enough. You end up what we call tunneling. Everything else on the side turns into a kind of fuzzy periphery.
As we discovered in speaking with Shafir, scarcity hijacks the mind and diminishes intelligence and lowers resistance to temptation. Of course, it's pretty easy to imagine the myriad impacts of financial poverty. But there are also grave effects for the relatively first world complaint about not having enough time.
I'm guessing a lot of your listeners will have had this experience where you're basically running around through a day where there's too much to do, and there's a deadline, you know, at the end of the day or the next morning, and there's just not enough time to attend and spend a lot of time focusing on your kids' homework or paying attention to your spouse's, you know, laments about something that happened to them that day. You're tunneling on the problem you have. You do much less well elsewhere. You might sleep less well because you're pulling an all-nighter to get the project done. The next day, there's data on this. When you've spent a night without sleep, you're just a little bit less smart and you do things less well.
How about
very similar to the money issue with the poor.
Well, Well, you write about some of the ways that public policymakers and health workers can accommodate or be sensitive to this tunneling and actually help build bandwidth. What are some examples of creating bandwidth?
Here's one way to think about it. We walk around with a very limited mental capacity, very limited bandwidth. We can only attend to a few things at a time. And that's kind of an interesting way to think about it, because what that means is that any time you give me a little bit of bandwidth somewhere, a little bit of a bandwidth gift, I have more of it now to attend to other things. To the extent that you make my banking easier, more trustworthy, more automatic, more manageable, at that moment I can spend less time juggling my banking and I have more time to, you know, eat well or attend to my kids' homework or anything else I want to do in life. And so the intuition here is, what can policymakers do, especially for people who struggle with poverty? Poverty, in some sense, you know, we're talking about different sources of scarcity as if they're all the same, but in many ways, poverty is a more extreme case. You know, many of us who are very busy, you know, between us, don't tell anybody, you know, that's something we choose to do. We don't have to do it this way. I mean, many of us who are busy because we're trying to, you know, exercise and go to the opera and read a good book and do good work and do better work than the other people around us and stuff like that. And, you know, if we fail to do one of those things, at the end of the day, very often nothing much happens. When you're poor in money, it's a very different story. There, if you fail to pay the rent on time, you're evicted. If you fail to get food on time, you're hungry. It's a much more extreme version of it. Mm-hmm. And so the notion is, what can policymakers do to alleviate some of that juggling, tunneling that's required of the poor to manage their everyday lives? And paradoxically, what you find is that, you know, the less poor often get a lot more help than the poorer. So, you know, we get reminders and automatic deposits and overdraft coverage and friendly banking and all kinds of things, and lawyers and accountants and drivers and nannies and maids and all the kinds of things that help us manage our everyday lives. And basically, for a little bit of money, we get more time. When you look at the poor, the whole thing is much more complicated. It's very hard to get more money for your time. You can work another hour or two and sleep a little bit less, but that's not going to give you much. And you often get a lot less help. You have less reliable lawyers and less friendly banks and less good instruments that help you save for retirement in automatic and painless fashion and all the kinds of things that would make life a little bit easier.
Well, although the circumstances for the very poor are different than most middle-class Americans, there is a psychological state. You know, one of my friends called it the disease of more. You know, there's never quite enough success or money or attention. Is scarcity a psychological state? And is that something that we can work our way out of?
I'm very reluctant to suggest that people who have a hard time finishing the month and feeding their children should work on having more modest tastes. Hmm. It is certainly true that in many cases, you know, both, you know, the richer who feel like they don't have enough money or the very busy who just take on too much and could easily do with less, there it's certainly true that you could imagine, you know, very smart ways of making things better by just, you know, developing slightly more modest wants and needs. It's a deep issue because there's often a critique about work that's done on the American poor saying, what do you mean they're poor? They all have, you know, TVs and
cell phones,
toasters and cars
and what
exactly. And that's sort of it's an interesting critique because it sounds sort of superficially like you got a point there, but it really is not very deep. And, you know, imagine I said to you, what do you mean they're poor? They all have running water. That just doesn't seem right. You know, things that used to be a luxury once now have become a basic feature of everyday American life. Yes, internet used to be an unimaginable luxury 20 years ago, but today, when it's a common staple and your kid at school basically needs internet access to do her homework, if you can't afford it, well, then yes, you're poor. And so in some deep way, there is a psychological element to it, because as society changes its norms and its standards, what it means to be poor will change with them, in the sense that there's certain things that you feel you ought to be able to afford, and all of a sudden you can't.
Eldar Shafir, professor of psychology and public affairs at Princeton and co-author of the new book Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much. On a global scale, time marches on, and its passing does mark some tectonic shifts in the balance of world power. Many economists project that China is poised to overtake the U.S. as the world's largest economy, production center, and possibly even innovator. These predictions have caused much public hand-wringing over losing ground. In one of our most counterintuitive rethinks of the series, economist Charles Kenny painted a much rosier picture. His book, The Upside of Down, Why the Rise of the Rest is Good for the West, argues that Americans should stop worrying and learn to love the decline. Charles Kenny is senior fellow at the Center for Global Development and a former senior economist at the World Bank. To help us understand his perspective, Kenny offered an example of how another former empire coped with losing its premier status.
When I was growing up, the United Kingdom was still, you know, in some sense, is still recovering from the fact that it used to be the world superpower and wasn't anymore. And there were a couple of slightly grim decades in there, largely self-inflicted grim decades. It was the United Kingdom not waking up to the fact that its role in the world had changed. And so, you know, the 50s really were a tough time in Britain. But only just after you saw perhaps the sort of the very nadir of the UK's global influence, when Egypt nationalized the Suez Canal and Britain and France tried to invade the country to get it back. And basically the United States said, you do that, we will wreck your economy. And Britain and France stopped trying to invade Egypt to get it back. Only a couple of years after that, the British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan was saying, you've never had it so good, to the British people. And he was absolutely right. If you look at in terms of income or health or education, Britain had never been a better place to live. And today, you know, it's a really great place to live. The food's got better, quality of life on a bunch of dimensions has got better. You know, the number of people with an inside toilet has gone up. You sort of name your dimension of the quality of life, and it's hugely better than it was when Britain controlled, you know, a quarter of the world's land surface. So, you know, really, there is a huge disconnect between how much global power a country has and how nice it is to live in that country. And I think we need to be focusing more on, you know, how nice is it to live here, because that's what most people really care about.
Well, you're talking about things that are sort of central to American identity. You'd certainly have some pushback in Congress against changing or diminishing the military budget. But there's this idea that being number one is so much a part of American identity. Is it even possible to convince the American public that being the biggest is not the best?
You know, what makes America such a wonderful and fantastic country is not the size of its GDP, and indeed for most of American history it didn't have the largest GDP. What makes America great is the founding values. We want to create a place where you can have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I think focusing on those things rather than GDP is returning to America's roots, if you will, and what really matters to the country. And being number one hasn't been all that great in terms of quality of life for America. And if you look at the period when the United States had the largest GDP, sort of from the 1930s and 40s onwards, it hasn't been a period of particularly high growth. The United States is slipping down the rankings globally in terms of things like life expectancy and child survival rates. It's slipping down the rankings when it comes to things like the quality of education. So, you know, being biggest hasn't actually paid off for the United States in terms of the things that matter to people's everyday lives. And I think, you know, fixating on it is just a mistake. And let's go back to fixating on the sort of core American values.
Beyond the economic power, geopolitical power, America is the country that is looked to for leading interventions, for international aids. I mean, the Syrian rebels are appealing to the United States, and nobody would be listening to the Secretary of State of, let's say, Lithuania pushing for Middle East peace, right? I mean, that kind of influence has an apparatus that comes with it and a way of thinking. What happens to that?
You know, I would not want the United States to disengage when it comes to global peacekeeping. I mean, I would, you know, point out that actually if you look at the percentage of the UN peacekeeping forces that come from the United States, the U.S. percentage to that global total of peacekeeping forces is 0.03%. Mm. America, you know, actually isn't playing the dominant role in a lot of these peacekeeping efforts. It tends to want to go it alone, and that's one of the things that I think could change to benefit both the United States and the rest of the world. But the U.S., you know, undoubtedly, overwhelmingly has much more capacity in things like, you know, airlifting troops and so on, and that's a vital role which can be of huge benefit both to America and the world. And I wouldn't want to see America giving up on that instantaneously. But I think there's a difference between saying there is still this vital role for American leadership in the world and saying that, you know, this ought to be our only or our primary focus when we think about what we're doing in the rest of the world, our primary focus being thinking about national security in the old sense of the term, you know, military dominance.
Charles Kenny is, among other things, former senior economist at the World Bank. You can find more on his latest book, The Upside of Down, Why the Rise of the Rest is Good for the West. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, we rethink environmental conservation. The plight of the endangered giant panda gets plenty of posters and T-shirts and airtime. But what about the slimy salamanders and creepy crawly ants and other uglier life forms on the brink of extinction? Word of Mouth considers what makes a species worth saving after the break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today we're reviewing some of the big takeaways from Word of Mouth's Rethink 2014 series. Among the things we learned is how irrational human beings can be, especially when prejudiced by overwhelming cuteness. Consider the giant panda, fuzzy, adorable, and ready for your 24/7 viewing pleasure on the National Zoo's PandaCam. It's in the top five most popular species for conservation. But what about the endangered species that make your skin crawl, but may also serve essential roles in their own ecosystems, like the St. Lucia racer snake or the Lord Howe Island stick insect? Christine Delamore is environmental writer and editor for National Geographic News. She asked the uncomfortable question of how we decide which species to save as part of Nat Geo's online series called The Last of the Last. I asked her which species are most popular among the public and the environmental organizations they support.
Well, often the ones that we feel like we can relate to kind of look into their eyes and see something of us in them. So maybe your elephant or your tiger. A lot of great ape species are very popular, as well as rhinos, but not so much your snakes and spiders and sort of the creepy crawly guys.
So these are the ones at the top of the food chain and the cutest. Do we have a bias for cute?
Yes, we do, exactly. And a lot of conservationists have recognized that despite, you know, what grand plans they have, we end up really saving what we want to save and what we like. So it's a real dilemma for some of the species that are really important to our environment, like ants, because they play such an important role in keeping our world healthy.
Yeah, hard to make an ant look especially cute.
Yes.
But how does that play out financially in terms of donations to conservation funds?
Well, actually, some conservationist groups have a strategy where they say, okay, let's donate money to the tiger because we know the public likes the tiger. But then what they do is use the tiger as a flagship and conserve an entire area where the tiger lives. And then lesser-known species, like a wild hog, for example, might benefit from that umbrella protection, even if it's not the target species that they're using to attract the public interest.
So what would be the ecological fallout if we do choose to save the panda or the tiger versus the ants, for example?
Well, a lot of insects, like in my story, I mentioned the American burying beetle, for example. They're crucial to keeping our soil healthy. They eliminate a lot of pests that eat our crops. They aerate the soil. They have a lot of behind-the-scenes roles.
So what are the kind of factors that go into determining which species are worth saving or prioritizing?
Mm-hmm. Well, different countries and different organizations have varying strategies. I mentioned in my article that Australia and New Zealand have just took on an economic approach. So actually putting data into a model and finding out which species can we save, which can we get the most bang for our buck.
Well, once again, I think I'm giving short shrift to some of those animals or species that we don't hear so much about. What are some of the others that you found in your reporting from six continents?
One of my favorites that we featured in our series was the hellbender. It has a lot of cool names. It's a giant salamander that lives in the eastern United States. Even in New York and parts of New England, you might not have even heard about it, but it's this 3-foot slimy amphibian that lives under rocks and streams, and it's been very heavily impacted by siltation, so buildup of sediment in the river and pollution. But it plays an important role in eating little invertebrates, and it's just a cool animal.
Well, Christine, are we doing this right? I mean, in a perfect world, is there a better model of deciding which species we prioritize in terms of conservation efforts?
I think that largely people need to just look at values, and that's what a lot of conservationists told me, is that the key is to influence people's values. And one of the examples is in China or other parts of Asia, they put shark fins in their soup at weddings. And some of the conservation funds they suggested should go to educating these people about what they're doing to sharks in the ocean and kind of shift the emphasis away from it being a luxury delicacy and toward something that they feel strongly about, that they don't want to be responsible for causing the extinction of a species. And shifting values is extremely difficult, but it seems like most conservationists think that's one of the main drivers in influencing whether a species lives or dies.
Christine's article, Saving the Earth's Rarest Species, is part of a new National Geographic series called Last of the Last. There's more information, including photographs of some of the adorable and maybe a little less adorable species she talked about, on our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We're disrupting the status quo today with a recap of some of our most popular segments from Word of Mouth's Rethink 2014 series. That's how we kicked off the new year, with ideas that could challenge our assumptions and maybe even inspire some new thinking. One interview from the series that became the most commented on or passed on to other people may not be so surprising, given that we talked about SEX. More accurately, fidelity and fantasy in long-term relationships. Esther Perel is a psychologist and sex therapist and author who specializes in couples and sexuality. She's also been married for a long time and is accustomed to juggling the demands of her children, her career, her marriage, and the human desire for independence and fulfillment. Her TED Talk on the secret to desire and a long-term relationship has had well over 2 million views, and her best-selling book is called Mating in Captivity, Reconciling the Erotic and the Domestic. The combination has turned her into a sought-after speaker on maintaining passion in relationships, which she notes is a relatively recent expectation.
Never before have we invested more in love as a part of marriage, as a constitutive part of marriage, and never have we divorced more in the name of the absence of that love. We have piled up expectations that we try to meet with one person to the extent that relationships sometimes crumble under the amount of expectations. We are asking one person to give us what we've always expected from long-term relationships or marriages: security, family life, companionship, social status, economic support. And we want that same person to also be our best friend and our trusted confidant and our passionate lover to boot. And we live twice as long. And that's a tall order for a party of two.
Yeah, that's an awful lot to put on a relationship. So there's this tension that a lot of couples have. What's driving that?
A few things are driving it, right? We are living in the West in a free world in which we have a market economy that doesn't just apply to finance, but also to romantic relationships, and in which the values of freedom and autonomy have become ultimate. We have today this concept of a passionate marriage, which used to be a contradiction in terms. Marriage was here and passion pretty much a privilege mostly for men that could experience it with far more safety than women, for whom the consequences were dire. And we want today one person and one relationship to give us two fundamental sets of human needs that are actually rather opposite and that spring from different sources and pull us in different directions, which is our need for security and our need for adventure. or in systemic language, our need for stability and our need for growth and change. Mm. This is the first time in the history of humankind where we have sex not because we want multiple children or because it's exclusively a woman's marital duty. We want sex that is rooted in desire, that is the sovereign expression of our free will. I want it.
So how do you keep that desire alive when you have kids and a job and you're exhausted and you've made dinner and done dishes and get the kids bathed and negotiate all of these different responsibilities that stifle eroticism?
Or one could say they may not necessarily stifle the erotic, but they displace it. If you look at many modern families, I would say that often the erotic energy is alive and well. But for that, you have to think of eroticism not as sex and the narrow meaning that we have attributed to the erotic. If you think about novelty, imagination, playfulness, curiosity, mystery, as essential erotic ingredients, they are all present in a family with children, but it's often eros redirected. The kids get novel activities and the couple does the same old, same old. The kids get to have multiple play dates and the couple will have an anniversary and a birthday. The question then becomes, how do people bring some of that energy back to the couple and why does it matter? It matters because for most couples in the West today, the survival of the family depends on the reasonable contentment of the couple. So on the long list of what your children need, a couple that has an erotic bond should feature as one of the main items.
Mm. It sounds to me like that's about intimacy. That's about living a life together. But you write that intimacy doesn't necessarily mean good sex. And I'd love to hear more about that because current thinking tells us that the two are intrinsically combined. I mean, it sounds like what couples therapists say to keep people together.
Yes. For me, intimacy, first of all, is a concept that has profoundly changed its meaning. It used to be a convivencia, a living together, a sharing of the daily, a raising of the children, a working of the land, attachment and habit. Intimacy today is a deep experience of recognition of my individuality, of my authentic self, for which you are going to be a validating, reflective listener that's going to help me transcend my existential aloneness. That is a very different kind of intimacy. Now, its connection to sexuality is highly questioned. If mutuality and reciprocity and protection and worry about the well-being of our partner and a sense of responsibility are part of the experience of love, then sometimes the very experience of responsibility, worry, and protection can be sexually deflating.
Your concept of intimacy also involves an idea of privacy. So tell us a little bit about this idea of personal intimacy.
Personal intimacy is the experience of interiority, of an inner world with oneself. What's interesting is that we live in the age of transparency, in which the same concept of intimacy has become equated with transparent, with wholesale sharing. We are close because we can tell each other everything, rather than we are close maybe because we don't have to tell each other everything, because we know that we have worlds and parts of us that remain personal and private. And a lot of this is very cultural. America definitely is on the far end of the transparency model, to the point where privacy has often been corroded and we experience two extremes, either secrecy or transparency. Mm-hmm. If you keep it to yourself, it means you don't trust me. It means, you know, you're hiding something from me. Otherwise, if you're close, there wouldn't be anything that you wouldn't want to share with me. And it becomes a whole tautology like that.
We're speaking with the psychologist and author Esther Perel about how to keep long-term relationships fresh, let's say, and healthy. Esther, you talked about the importance of personal intimacy, but what about using that concept as a right to unmitigated privacy or a justification for having an affair? Are you saying in some cases that infidelity can be okay?
Look, the question of what is separate and what is together is a fundamental question that belongs to the making of any couple. Every couple decides what is separate and what is common, what thoughts need to be shared, what finances need to be shared, what fantasies can need to be shared, and what remains personal, what friends can remain your own and what friends have to be joined, what movies you can see on your own, or if you have to see only the movies that both of us want to see. This is an organizing principle of any intimate relationship. The difference between heterosexual couples maybe and homosexual couples is that in straight couples, there is an assumption that is made up front so that the question is rarely negotiated, certainly not in the sexual realm, because that threatens the sacred ideal of the romantic myth. What you're asking me is to take something that is a lot more ambiguous and a lot more complex and make determinations that have never been able to be made. Adultery has existed forever since marriage came along. It is so central that even the Bible knew to repeat it twice in the Ten Commandments, once for doing it and once just for thinking about it. So maybe we're not facing such a new reality after all.
Mm. Let's talk about something a little more concrete that you found from people when you traveled around the world on your book tour and asked people, when do you find yourself most drawn to your partner? I'm interested to hear what you found.
You know, it's a question that I originally asked. I've asked it in about 22 countries. Mating in Captivity is translated in about 25 languages. And I thought there must be major cultural differences. And except for one answer that is gender-based, which is when the women say, when I see him playing with the children, which is very sexy and not the other way around, none of the answers are gender-bound. They cross back and forth. But they basically organize themselves in four groups of answers. One would be when I am separated from my partner, when he or she is away, when we reunite, mm-hmm. highlighting the notion that desire also is rooted in absence and in longing. So that's the first group of answers, which we could elaborate. The second one was when I see my partner doing something that he or she is competent about, passionate about, in their element, self-sufficient. Basically, when I see my partner as an other, separate from me, that I do not need to take care of. And that experience of a radiant other, where there is no caretaking and no sense of responsibility, is highly charged with attraction, with desire, with admiration, which is an essential element of desire. The third group was when he or she or I, when we surprise each other, highlighting the notion of novelty, of breaking of routine, of the eruption of desire. And surprise could be going and doing something that's different from the usual, or seeing my partner as vulnerable, not because vulnerability is so attractive, but because I don't typically get to see my partner in that space. And then the other one was when we're on vacation, when the kids are not there, basically highlighting the playfulness, the open-endedness, the non-productive nature of erotic sex, meaning sexuality that is transformed by our imagination, or the poetics of sex, basically. So these groups began to highlight that you look at this person that's already so familiar, and momentarily they are once again somewhat mysterious, somewhat unknown, somewhat elusive, and in that space between me and the other lies the erotic elan.
Mm. So Esther Perel, with those things in mind, does a perfect marriage exist, or what does a really great marriage look like to you?
I don't think I ever would apply the word perfect to marriage, but then I won't necessarily apply to that many things as well. I think the question that I would like to ask is, when you look around, what is an inspired relationship for you? How many people around you do you know that you find inspire you, that have a certain spark? You know, we often allow marriages to exist in ways that we wouldn't allow a single other systems, organization, or living organism to actually survive on this planet. Hmm. We don't invest nearly as much in our relationships as we will invest in our businesses, in our houses. You know, the wedding contract is nothing compared to a business contract. So my question is, a couple that feels alive, when I went around and asked, it's not about separate people living separate life at all, but it is about people who have a fundamental respect for the freedom, the existential freedom of another person. That is not the freedom to cheat and all of that, but basically the sense that you don't confuse intimacy with surveillance and you don't confuse intimacy with fusion. It is a relationship where two people are able to continue to grow. You know, we used to die 7 years after we were done raising our kids. Today we have this phase where we say, is this it? And that thirst for feeling alive, which means that there is still surprise to come, that new things can still emerge, new experience we haven't known, that is what keeps us on the edge of our seats. It is the difference between not being dead and being alive. And I think that a thriving relationship very much focuses on that distinction.
Esther Perel is a psychotherapist and author who specializes in couples and sexuality. Her best-selling book is called Mating in Captivity, Reconciling the Erotic and the Domestic. And you can find a link to Esther's TED Talk and much more on her at wordofmouthradio.org. When we come back, we're going to turn our focus to the forum of the TED Talk itself and rethink whether some ideas really are worth spreading. That's when Word of Mouth continues in just a minute. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Since its inception in 1984, the annual TED Conference has grown to attract big-name speakers with talks that routinely go viral across the internet. Guided by its motto of presenting ideas worth spreading, TED has exploded into countless TED Global and regional TEDx events and via NPR's TED Radio Hour, which airs right here at NHPR. Despite that undeniable success, a speaker at a recent San Diego TEDx event dared to ask whether the ideas presented at TED really are worth spreading.
The key rhetorical device of any TED talk is a combination of epiphany and personal testimony. The speaker shares some personal story of insight and revelation, its trials and tribulations. What does the TED audience hope to get from this? Vicarious insight, a fleeting moment of wonder, a sense that maybe it's all going to work out after all, spiritual buzz? Well, I'm sorry, but this is not up to the challenge of the problems that we are ostensibly here to face.
Benjamin Bratton is Associate Professor of Visual Arts at UC San Diego. Benjamin's anti-TED talk has ignited a public discussion over the value and purpose of the TED brand. When I spoke with him, I admitted that I've been a fan of TED, watching many TED Talks, emceed for TEDx events, and even put together my own TED Talk about the bonds created by listening.
Well, first let me say that I also have a lot of friends and colleagues who have done TED Talks, done really great TED Talks. And if someone watches a TED Talk and they learn something and they get something out of it, that's fine. I just think that TED has become such a dominant format in how the public discussion about technology, design, innovation is structured and in which we participate in it, that its limitations are amplified. And to me, its limitations have to do with the way in which it asks speakers, demands the speakers, to articulate their work in a particular kind of way. And that is a kind of evangelical, almost missionary kind of rhetoric. And to position the audience and to position us and to position this conversation into one in which the experience of optimism takes priority over the seriousness and ambiguity and contradictions and difficult work that really should be the basis of the discussion. There's the corollary to placebo science and placebo medicine is placebo politics and placebo innovation. And on that count, I think TED has a long way to go.
meaning that you can talk something over. But as you say in your talk, why is so little that is proposed in TED Talks, why does so little of that actually happen? So this is just a, I don't know, a placebo effect. It makes everybody feel good having heard an idea, but nobody does anything about it. What are you after here?
Well, a little of both. Clearly that, you know, if we're going to be talking about big ideas and grand challenges and very difficult things, then we can't expect things to change overnight. But that isn't really the core of my point. It's more that when the experience of optimism and the experience of some kind of epiphany and insight and everything becomes almost in a religious, almost like a religious service, the ultimate goal and outcome of these events, then it's impossible to have a serious discussion that might actually lead towards something that could have a lasting effect. So as I say in the talk, if we invest in things that make us feel good but which don't actually work, and don't invest in things which don't make us feel good but which may actually lead towards some outcome, then our fate is that it'll just get harder and harder to feel good about not solving problems.
Mm. I'd like to play a clip from your talk. You're speaking here about how most TED Talks oversimplify complex issues.
I was recently at a presentation that a friend of mine, astrophysicist, was making to a potential donor. And I thought this talk was lucid, it was engaging, and I'm a professor of visual arts here at UC San Diego. At the end of the day, I know nothing about astrophysics. The donor, however, said, "You know what, I'm going to pass. I'm just not inspired. You should be more like Malcolm Gladwell." Now, at this point, I kind of lost it. Can you imagine? I mean, think about it. A scientist who creates real knowledge should be more like a journalist who recycles fake insights.
Whoa, snap. I mean, but is there no, you're talking about Malcolm Gladwell. You know, he's a very popular journalist, definitely a TED talking type. But is there no value in this, Benjamin, in having an exuberant messenger sell something that we may not have known about before, a foreign concept, a different way of thinking about something? Is that any different than maybe in the old days sitting in a cafe and hearing somebody's wild idea?
I think having a open, democratic, welcoming public discussion about the ideas of our time, the problems that we all face, is not only a good idea, it's absolutely necessary. And that's why when one forum, one format for the forum, one content play comes to dominate that discussion, then the pathologies of that format end up having negative effects on everything that it touches. And I'm glad you played that clip, because you have a situation in which if research is less able to articulate itself according to the sort of marketing speak, kind of advertising slogans, it doesn't get funded. It doesn't get supported. And if our goal is to actually focus that open democratic public discussion on solving problems, then the experience of feeling like we're doing something cannot take precedence over actually doing something. Mm.
Well, TED has not, to its credit, branded itself as a solution to the world's biggest problems, but ideas worth spreading, which is fairly humble in comparison. Are you placing too much responsibility on TED for actually doing the solving?
No, I don't think TED is supposed to be a place where a mechanism through which we solve these problems. And I never indicated that it was or criticized it for not being the mechanism through which we solve the problems. We solve the problems through, as I say, a robust, open, serious, adult discussion about the problems that we face. I think it would serve the audience better. I think it would serve the discussion better to narrow the focus of the discussion onto something that almost seems too small of a problem to really spend much time with, and to go as deep and as possible into that problem from multiple different perspectives at once, sort of, you know, Rashomon kind of thing. And I think what you find is that when you investigate something in real detail and care, that when you crack it open, the whole universe is in there. So focus on something very specific, go very, very deep, as opposed to very, very wide and shallow, because TED has wide and shallow covered.
Benjamin Bratton from UC San Diego is director of the Center for Design and Geopolitics at Calit 2. You can see his anti-TED talk at wordofmouthradio.org. We'll be right back. thank you for spending some time rethinking things with word of mouth. There is much more online. If you do like what you heard or simply looking to challenge your own preconceived notions, you can find all the interviews on our website, wordofmouthradio.org, or pass them around, email them to friends. It's easy to do, again, at wordofmouthradio.org. The State of the State address is going to be on in this spot tomorrow, but you can hear Word of Mouth's Best Of this week on Saturday at noon. We'll be back again on Monday at 2 on NHPR, online anytime at wordofmouthradio.org, and please stay safe and warm out there.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio,
follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth,
and check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.